Carlson.
Here.
Kristen Chu.
Here.
Kevin Hughes. Brian Larkin.
Here.
Brenda Quee McNulty.
Here.
Alexander Tonneson.
Here.
You have a quorum. Item two, opportunity for the public to comment on any matters within the committee's jurisdiction that are not on the agenda.
Seeing no public comment at this time, let's proceed to the next item.
Item three, approval with possible modifications of the minutes of the July 17, 2017 meeting.
If no comments, I would make a motion to approve the minutes.
Second.
So,
any public comment?
Well, we don't have any, do we?
So approved?
Well, we vote.
Public comment.
Public call.
Public comment.
Do we need to get public comment first? Yeah. At this moment, before we vote, let's invite public comment on any on this item, which is minutes of our last meeting.
Oh, yeah.
Seeing no public comment, let's vote on approving the minutes.
Approve.
Aye. All approved. Okay, let's move on to the next item, number four.
Item four, presentation from Public Works about the 2011 Road Repaving and Street Safety Bond Program and possible action by the committee in response to such presentation. Madam Chair, for the record, I'm giving the committee an updated version of the report.
Good morning.
That's okay.
John.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Thomas, Deputy Director for Public Works, here to report on the road repaving and street safety bond of 2011. On our first slide, we have just an overview of the breakdown of the bond. It was a $248 million bond approved by the voters, broken down into six categories: street repaving and reconstruction, $149 million; streetscape, bike ped safety, $50 million; traffic signal and street improvements, $20 million; sidewalk accessibility and curb ramps, $14 million; sidewalk accessibility sidewalks, $8 million; and street structures, $7 million. To date, we have expended 82.6%, or $206.7 million. With an additional $19.4 million encumbered under contracts, and the remaining $21 million largely is for labor, but there are two contracts yet to be awarded, which will take approximately $7 million of that remaining 21. To the right, you'll see a couple of slides from recent streetscape projects, decorative crosswalks, raised crosswalks, and green infrastructure along the Wiggle. So two of those slides on the top right and top and bottom right are from the Wiggle project, which is a bicycle improvement project as well as a green infrastructure project being constructed essentially between DeBose and Oak. Slide two, just kind of some highlights on the project. Under paving, we have completed 46 out of a planned 50 projects or construction contracts. We have completed 1,305 blocks of a planned 1,423 blocks, or 92%. That is the revised goal. You may recall that originally we had broken the paving into two segments, $139 million for road reconstruction and paving, and another $10 million going to what we referred to as HOPE-SF, a development project in the Hunters Point area. There was a decision made to move that project, those funds, entirely under the paving program and fund the HOPE-SF work by general fund work money instead. So that happened some time ago, and we revised the total blocks for paving accordingly. Over this past quarter, we've had some completions. The Fulton Streetscape Improvement Project was completed in March. We have joined paving to an Inner Sunset Streetscape project, which is just about to commence. Installed the decorative crosswalks I showed on the previous slide. Along Irving, we have metal gateway structures, which are being fabricated now and will be installed in the next month or so to complete the Irving streetscape project. And we expect to have a ribbon cutting on that project later this fall. As far as upcoming milestones, that Wiggle project I mentioned earlier is expected to be completed by January of 2018. Contractor is currently working on the pedestrian bulb outs, raised crosswalks, stormwater collecting bulb outs along that whole alignment. The intent of that is to slow down both vehicular and bicycle speeds through those intersections to improve safety for peds as well as bikes. Just a recap on overall, we had three bond sales, which includes interest now to date for a total of $250 million. There was just over $2 million in interest added to the program. We had the third and final bond sale just over a year ago. And again, as we have said, 83% has been expended, a little over 91% expended and or encumbered. Some details about the street repaving project. For those of you who were part of the committee when we began this process, we reported that our PCI, or pavement condition index, was around 65. It has improved now to 69 with the infusion of the additional bond monies and then continued support from the general fund since all of that money had been committed. So we are seeing a nice upward trajectory on that pavement condition index. We are, I believe, now the leader in the Bay Area counties in terms of pavement condition, but still below what our goal is and what the overall regional goal is. The graph to the bottom right, again, depicts not only the improvement that we've seen in the PCI, but also the projection on what different levels of funding will result in. So as you can see, the slope downward, which is in red, shows that if we were to drop back to our previous pavement budgets, the pavement condition in just about 6 or 7 years could drop precipitously all the way back to a 62, even below where we were. Continued expenditure at our current level will get us up to that 70 and then maintain. And it would require a substantial improvement or increase in the commitment to get to that higher number of 84. The 84 is significant only because at that level you are able to reduce your paving budget after that point, and that is because you can perform less expensive treatments to the pavement that will extend its life. But that costs a significant amount of money to get to that. So at this point, the future projections are that we'll stay at the 70.
John, can I ask a question?
Of course.
It's interesting because I'm just beginning to understand how this index works. You always show that 84, this kind of ideal number. Mm-hmm. Do we get a sense, based on our knowledge of other major cities, how many cities are at that level, or do we get a set?
I can't think of any off the top of my head.
So it's not something that is being done by other major cities?
No. I think, in fact, many cities have failed to fund paving and have found themselves in a big hole, many in much, much deeper hole than San Francisco. And I think it was a timely commitment by the voters and the electeds to make a decision to invest as we have.
Thank you.
If I could just ask, too, when these particular bond funds are just about expended for resurfacing, are there bond funds in the other transportation for resurfacing, or?
There are not.
So when will we drop to the $23 million in not this fiscal year, but the next fiscal?
We have continued since, essentially, we committed all the funds in the bond in the first 3 years. And so it's taken time because, as I've mentioned in previous reports, that these are all joint projects, so they're much longer term than a strict paving project. So we work with PUC and MTA to do sewer, water, and other things. But the city has committed general fund dollars since 2015. So 2016, 2017, they've committed the additional some $40 million, $45 million per year and have committed for several more years.
So we can stay at this 65 without another bond?
We're at 69 issue, now.
69, yes. But we can stay there without another bond?
69. We should hit 70 in the next 2 years, okay. Yes, at our current level of funding. And, of course, there are efforts being made to find a more stable funding source going forward, but that hasn't quite finished yet.
Thank you.
Okay, so, again, that's just to recap on the total. We had an original goal of $1,275. We revised that to $1,423 as a result of that additional $10 million that moved over from HOPE-SF. At the top, you also see that there is still about $9 million remaining remaining balance in the paving program. And that's largely the labor. It's the construction management costs. It's the striping costs that are paid to the MTA in labor fees. So that's the remainder of the monies there. Moving on to streetscape. Of the original $50 million, we had added $2 million in interest to this, so a total budget of now $52 million. 65% of that has been expended. Another 13% is encumbered, so $40 million of the $52 million has either been expended or encumbered. There are several contracts I mentioned earlier which will be bid later this year and into early next year, which would complete the full the full streetscape approved project list, but construction is expected to be completed in late 2018 and early 2019 for those projects. There are two different categories, and again, without going into a lot of detail, we had some 24 large scope streetscape projects and another 50 or so smaller, what we called follow the paving projects. Nearly 70% of those 73 projects are now substantially complete. Curb ramp program and the sidewalk program are also completed. There are just a few dollars in those programs which were likely to move over to either paving or streetscape to add to their budgets because this work is completed. And the roadway structure program is 100% expended at this point. There is just some final closeout work on two of the 40 projects, but all work is substantially complete on those. So overall, the program is largely done with just some remaining work in paving and streetscape. And then the last section is traffic signals, which is managed by the MTA. About $19 million has been expended. They have just a small amount of money left for final cleanup on that project, but or in that phase of the program. So again, all looking like we will be complete with the majority of this work in 2018. The status of the budget and financial plan is shown here. I won't go into detail on this, but I'm happy to answer any questions you may have. This is largely unchanged other than the expended and encumbered columns. So a couple of slides on change orders. Again, broken down and happy to answer questions, but it's broken down by program as both a dollar value and a percent. to show you where the change orders have been largely occurring. One thing I've mentioned in the past, and we still have not yet resolved this on the reporting, is that some of our contracts are issued as needed contracts. They have no defined scope other than the contractors will bid on certain bid items, whether it be pavement or curb or sidewalk or what have you. So they'll give us a unit price on those contracts, and then we will issue scope for specific task orders to them. Once that is done, the system records that as a change order. And so that's part of why you see what looks like a large change order or a larger percentage of change orders there. But in reality, those are part of the base contract. And so we're striving to revise that way of reporting so it's more clear. And then also under street resurfacing, a similar challenge. There was it's a small budget program overall, and there was a large change order added to one of those contracts as an owner request to protect the abutments on a bridge at Highland Bridge. And so that's reflected here. Bond funds weren't used for it, but it was a change order to the contract. So again, you're seeing a large change order percentage. So that concludes my report. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Can you talk through the change order, client request decision-making process there?
Sure. In that case, we had problems at that bridge location with graffiti and vandalism and other challenges that were possibly putting the abutment at risk. There was excavation next to the abutment, and so there were things that needed to be done, and we had a contract in place. So our director had received the complaints from the board member, had our team go out and take a look at it and develop alternatives. Those were brought back to our director for his review, and we made a determination to install a security fence under both sides of the bridge at the abutments to protect that.
But again,
bond funds were not used. We were able to find general fund to add into the contract.
Yeah, I didn't necessarily mean specifically about that one, but in general, this affects a lot of the bonds that we're doing is that, changes come from a lot of different areas, but particularly the ones where you're trying to do a lot of different things simultaneously,
particularly
for different departments. I'm trying to understand the effect of managing expectations on bringing in the budgets on time.
Right. So as you can see, the legend to the left, there are four basic categories that we focus on. So unforeseen conditions, client requests, errors and omissions, and then any code changes that might drive a change during construction that's necessitated. Client requests, again, if they're the funding agent, we generally will work with them to see if that can't be implemented during the life of the contract and if it's, a prudent decision to be made while the work is underway. That is evaluated in concert with the other agency. Unforeseen conditions, they are what they are, unfortunately. There are many things that are not documented under the street. Infrastructure projects in particular do have a fairly significant number of unforeseen conditions. Our errors and omissions have not been a significant portion of our contracts and certainly meet or stay below the industry standard of roughly 3%.
But specifically for the client requests, you said the funding agency, that being the client.
Correct.
Are they considered the funding agency or the bond is considered the funding agency?
So there are a lot of different scenarios that this could come under. If it is a joint project with PUC, they are considered the funding agency. They have ratepayer dollars that they often will bring into a contract to install sewer, et cetera. What often happens if a new sewer is being installed, it's perhaps a 100-year-old sewer, as many of ours are. The laterals are aged. There's an assumption made at the beginning of the contract. They fund a certain percentage, say 30% of the laterals are assumed to need to be repaired. We've had some where it requires 100%. The engineer goes out and evaluates and says they all need to be replaced. And so there's a fairly significant uptick in the cost associated with that. And as I called them, the funding agency will decide to provide additional funds to complete that work. But it's always in consultation with them that occurs.
Okay. So you guys are the ones making sure that the bond funds are used in the way that the voters
yes, of course.
Expected?
Yes.
I've been reading in the paper about some of the questions on streets that are not under the control of the city but under the state or the federal government. And I wonder if you might explain a little bit about how those are handled so that any blowback on poor conditions by them doesn't come back to you.
The blowback seems to happen anyway. But there are, as you know, four state highways that run through San Francisco. The report that was published some time ago focused on the local highway system in Northern California, Oakland, San Francisco, and the surrounding areas, and that received a very low score. That included 19th, Lombard, Sloat, as well as Van Ness. All of those contracts for various reasons or projects for various reasons have been on hold with Caltrans, whether it be for funding. They delayed implementation of Van Ness as a result of our Van Ness BRT project and have added the funds into that. They have shop funds for 19th and Lombard. They're currently paving Sloat. So they're all kind of in process right now. 19th and Lombard, however, through negotiations with Caltrans, have been coordinated with our utility work that we need to perform. So we are upgrading both sewer and water, as well as, I believe, AWSS on 19th Avenue are all being upgraded, as well as MTA sidewalk extensions or bulb outs are being installed along that corridor, both Lombard and 19th. So we have put together a separate project in advance with Caltrans approval on both 19th and Lombard. Those are at about 95% today, and we expect them to advertise for construction in the spring, and then Caltrans will pave after that. They're very extensive projects, some 2 to 3 years in duration, so we won't see significant increases or improvements in pavement condition on those corridors, at least those three corridors, while the major construction projects are underway. Sloat is underway today, and they will conclude that work hopefully by the end of this year. So that's one out of the four. But the remaining projects have a substantial way to go.
I wonder if it might not be helpful to you and the public to put a paragraph on your report that says the following streets are under state control. If you'd like more information on them, here's a phone number or a link to go to and hand it off.
We can certainly look at doing that.
You mentioned that you opened up some of the streets and you do utilities. If you're looking ahead to us having internet service that's or undergrounding electrical wires and so forth, do you see an opportunity for that in the future? The near future, like next week?
Both of those topics have come under significant discussion, neither of which has substantial funding. There was a dig once ordinance that was passed several years ago. The city has chosen to fund that to a low degree a couple of times, but not enough to follow all of our projects. We have worked with DT to add fiber conduit to several of our contracts, Columbus, Potrero, I believe Fulton had it as well. So certain corridors that they've been able to select where they could sort of judiciously use the funds that they have been worked in concert with ours so that you minimize disruption and minimize impact to our infrastructure. But there isn't a continuous funding source in order to allow that to keep going. Undergrounding is even more dire. The funds that were provided for undergrounding a decade or more ago were fully expended. PG&E doesn't have any additional funds. The only project I'm aware of that will have any undergrounding of significance is Second Street. We have issued a contract for improvements along Second Street from Market down to Townsend, to King. And there's a roughly four-block segment in there that the wires are above ground, and we're working with PG&E to underground those. Funding was found for that work, but it's rare and few and far between where we get options. Many people have come to me looking for opportunities for that. There's a sort of coalition of interested neighbors and neighborhoods for undergrounding, but thus far I haven't seen any sources that will support that. I think they had estimated the cost could be in excess of $3 to $5 billion to underground.
I see that at the current, at the moment, the city is negotiating with PG&E over contract disputes, where PG&E thinks that it should be paid more money than it is now. And so instead of looking at this in a silo of street repaving and opening up, it might be possible in the future to look at leveraging that or including something in an earthquake safety bond, since having wires fall down is an earthquake hazard. I'm just throwing out stuff that it's not actually off the top of my head, but it's just one level below.
Any other comment?
Yeah, I just had one other question, because it's come up in, when you read the controller's report on all the bond funds, it comes up, and it comes up in these meetings, that a lot of the delays, which are often costly, are due to interagency lack of communication. And just for transportation, I recall there was some kind of a structure or organization that was attempting to coordinate between agencies, PUC, Muni, DPW, PG. Does that organization still exist, and is it effective in your mind?
So we certainly coordinate on every project.
For roadway project.
I understood. One of the problems that we've faced, and I think I've reported on here in the past, is that each agency which we have to work with has not necessarily had the funds to support the programs that we're working on. So as an example, as you mentioned, MTA support. So if we're working on a street that has overhead lines and we require MTA to shut down the overhead lines and or relocate or reroute the buses, they have so many contracts and so many commitments throughout the city that everybody sort of has to get in line, whether it be inspectors or overhead linesmen or drivers or vehicles themselves. So all of those things contribute to kind of a lack of availability. Now, the MTA has been working with us. They have hired nearly a dozen new inspectors, but the latest problem is really overhead lines folks. They've been working so many hours, so long, they can't get additional.
I understand that. What I'm my question is, though, is there some organizational structure within the city that brings people together monthly or bimonthly to review the coordination of projects?
So there are at least five different coordination meetings that happen for different purposes. So you're aware of Invista
every month?
Every month.
Okay.
You're aware of Invista, the system that allows us to send out a notice of intent. All players are aware of what projects we intend to do. So that's the start of our coordination effort. We have monthly meetings with the two directors. Actually, now PUC joins us. So we have PUC, MTA, and Public Works with the directors come together to talk about program needs and support. So we have regular communication at the top level on that, as well as committee members at lower levels to keep that going.
Any other comment from members? Good. So we'll conclude the presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next is the MTA presentation. Ms. Webster, let me just hold back before you come on. I had forgotten to invite public comment to the last presentation, so I'm going to invite public comment to Mr. Thomas' presentation at this point. Seeing none, Ms. Webster, you can start.
Okay. Item 5. Presentation from the SFMTA about the 2014 Transportation and Road Improvement General Obligation Bond and possible action by the committee in response to such presentation.
Okay, good morning, Chair and members of the committee. I'm Monique Webster. I am the Senior Manager of Capital Finance for the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency. And I'm here to report on our 2014 Transportation and Road Improvement Bond. Going to the first slide, this is a brief overview of the $500 million bond. It was passed by the voters in 2014 and provides funding in eight categories: Muni Forward Rapid Network Improvements, Muni Facility Upgrades, Pedestrian Safety Improvements, Complete Streets Improvements, Caltrain Upgrades, Accessibility Improvements, Major Transit Corridor Improvements, and Traffic Signal Improvements. The bonds overall were provided to provide issued to provide safer and faster access to transportation and getting around streets in San Francisco. To date, we've issued $66 million, and that is indicated in blue. The $66 million was issued in four categories. So those are Muni Forward Rapid Network Improvements, Pedestrian Safety Improvements, Caltrain Upgrades, and Major Transit Corridor Improvements. Overall, the entire $500 million bond is planned to deliver over 50 projects and will leverage federal, state, and regional funding. So expenditures as of the end of the last quarter, as of June 30th, were $22 million expended, which represents about 34% of the first issuance of $66 million. Another $17 million was encumbered for total expenditures and encumbrances of about 60% of the overall issuance. So I'm just going to turn it over right now to my colleague, Sean Kennedy, who will talk about major milestones and accomplishments on the projects that are funded.
Thank you, Monique. Good morning. Sean Kennedy with SFMTA. And want to talk through a few highlights from the last quarter, from the previous quarter. The picture you see on that slide is a completed project on 11th. That's actually 11th and Harrison. It's a new transit boarding island there. You see the green path behind it. It's the bikeway. And then leaves a lot of room for actual boarding space, safe boarding area. Speeds up boarding. So boarding is then the lightings are a little faster now at this stop, as well as the bus doesn't have to pull in and out of the stop, and improves reliability and reduces travel time. Mission and Turnbull is an intersection that's being upgraded to address specifically pedestrian safety issues. The curb work there has been completed, and we are just waiting now to install the traffic signal, which will go up, should be within the next several weeks. 30 Stockton on Chestnut Street, as well as the 5 Fulton between 6th and Market, are both under construction right now. The Chestnut project is actually well ahead of schedule construction-wise. There's one intersection left to finish. That's at Fillmore and Chestnut. And the 5 Fulton is also proceeding nicely. 5 Fulton, I think, projected to be completed by April of 2018. So coming up fairly quickly. And Judah between Arguello and 9th is also under construction, and I believe was mentioned very briefly by John in the previous discussion. But DPW is repaving all the way to 19th, but the segment that we're funding and doing is 9th to Arguello. NTP has been issued. The words here are of course based on last quarter, but this. So far, since then, we've actually completed the NTP, and work has started. They've already had two weekend shutdowns, mostly doing utility work at 9th and Judah to get ready for some sewer and water work that will be coming up, and it's a two-year construction project. 7 Haight, the upper Haight portion of the project, has reached 100% design, and we hope to advertise in the next several weeks. And the construction schedule would be aiming to start construction in the beginning of January, and it'll be an 18-month or so project to complete that. And then Better Market Street, huge project, obviously a lot of different agencies involved in this project. But in the last quarter, we were able to reach a kind of consensus on what to move forward with. Right now, we're working on finishing up the CEQA and NEPA process. This will probably take roughly a year or so. And doing CER work, which is the up to 30% design for the entire project. And then we'll work on 100% design for the initial segment, which it looks like we're talking with City Family Partners about doing an initial segment of that corridor from 6th to 8th, so that those improvements can get out in the street early. So those are the general highlights. I'll turn it back over to Monique to finish us off, and then glad to take questions at the end.
Hello again. So in terms of project changes and challenges, there were several projects that had scheduled changes, six projects with scheduled changes this last quarter that are listed here, and the changes are described in more detail in the report itself. One of these projects, the Mission Street and Trumbull project, actually the project schedule was accelerated slightly by a quarter. And other schedule changes were made primarily to reflect new construction schedules. On the Caltrain project, as reported to you back in March, Caltrain had to terminate its contract with its with the firm that was responsible for designing and implementing the project back in February. And they are moving forward now. But they did have to extend the schedule, which they've known about for some time, but they finally were able to give us the final schedule adjustment, which moves the schedule out by about 15 months, and that's also reflected in the report. Oops, sorry. We also had a supplemental appropriation that was approved over the summer by the Board of Supervisors and the mayor. What it does is it moves $26.2 million from this first issuance from some of the originally funded categories into the facilities category of the program. This allows us to fund projects that are ready to go into construction and move money away from some projects that had slower than originally anticipated spending. The facilities upgrades category wasn't originally included in the initial appropriation, so that's why we had to seek a supplemental appropriation to move the funds to that category. With that, we expect spending to further accelerate, and we should see the first issuance about 80% expended by the end of this calendar year and then fully expended by the middle of next year. Also not mentioned on this slide, but we are working with the controller's office and the mayor's office on a second issuance, and we are hoping to advance that at some point in the next few months. Right now, that is looking to be at about $184 million issuance across all eight categories, funding 37 projects. And that is the end of our presentation.
Mr. Larkin, Would you like to comment?
Well, I'll do the liaison report in a minute, but first I wanted to ask a question that I didn't ask when we met last week, and that was on the two completed projects, and I think Sean can address this. What was the percentage of change orders, the cost percentage?
That is a good question. I would have to get back to you on that. I don't remember doing any change orders for either one of those, so I'll have to get back to you.
Yeah, and I didn't mean to blindside you with this. It's just something that I forgot to ask during the presentation, because during the public comment phase, we often get questions about change orders.
Sure.
Not necessarily enlightened questions, but questions just the same. And I'd like to get an idea where we are on that, because, again, in our position as oversight, that's a relevant question. If you could get back about that,
definitely.
You know, you've got my contact information.
Great.
As far as the liaison report, I had four points that I wanted to make. We heard, Brenda and I heard during our meeting with the three staff members that you see here today, Charlotte and Monique and Sean, that they had made this supplemental appropriation. It got approved, rather, by the Board of Supervisors, and we both were surprised, Brenda and I were surprised, that the amount of what I'll call administrative overhead was involved in getting that approval. In other words, all they wanted to do was move funds among and between some of the projects for which they'd already approved, and I think the first slide that we look at in this presentation, this one here, there are these blue and white crosshatched areas, and that's where bonds have already been sold. Well, that's their best guess at how much money they were going to need. Well, it turned out MTA staff, wanted to move money between and among some of those things. In order to do that, they had to get board of supervisors approval. This seems like perfunctory project management. This is something that, in trying to manage a program like this, you'd want to do it without the hassle of having to go to the board of supervisors. For one thing, I don't think the board of supervisors cares that much. They've got other things to worry about. And it's not as though there's any sleight of hand here. This is just moving money because you're spending some aspects of the programs slightly faster than you anticipated, and another slightly slower. This is just a way to keep the thing moving and as expeditiously, and that word efficient, as they can. So I would like to recommend to whomever that the Board of Supervisors not need to be to approve this kind of action. Secondly, Brenda and I, attended the April 5th meeting of the Board of Supervisors Government Audit and Oversight Committee, and I think we've reported about this before, but it's worth noting again. Two of the things that had caused, I guess, slowness in the expenditure of some of the bond money that they had already achieved and already had access to were slow coordination among agencies, DPW and MTC, especially on street projects. And DPW and MTC try to coordinate on all of these. In trying to coordinate among these agencies, among and between these agencies, sometimes time is lost. If there was a problem, for instance, what was it on the 7-8, where they a subcontractor hit an underground line and needed to be terminated, that slowed up the entire bunch of projects that were going on at that time. And that is going to happen. Now, I guess the solution to this is to try to come up with better ways of coordinating, because this kind of stuff is going to happen. When you dig, you're going to find stuff you didn't expect to find. Someone's going to hit some stuff. It's going to delay projects overall. How you would mitigate that, I don't know, but I'll leave it to the professionals. And there was also, in delaying the expenditure, another reason for delaying expenditure were rebids required. Again, I think, was that on the 5 Fulton project? 3 times the project had to be rebid because the only bidder did not meet the LBE goal. And I'm going to speak as a local business enterprise certified by the City of San Francisco. If the goal is too high, you got to revisit that. This is costing the taxpayers money. It's causing delays. And as an LBE, that's not worth it to me. If you got to lower the goal, you got to lower the goal. If there aren't enough contractors out there who can do and are willing to do the work at a given time, then the goal has to be adjusted accordingly. One other thing that Brenda and I, did not report to the Board of Supervisors during that April meeting was that Caltrain needed to replace its general contractor on its positive train control contract. Well, that's going to slow. If they have to slow down, if they have to replace a contractor, it's going to delay that contract. It's going to slow the flow of funds, another reason that things happened. Finally, on the second issuance, you all just heard about this today. I'm hoping, and I'm going to recommend to the Board of Supervisors and to whomever is listening, because we got television now, that the city or that the board does approve that second issuance in a timely manner to avoid delays and added costs that come with those delays. And that is all I have to say.
Other comments?
Yeah, I was reading the detailed report on the second issuance, and it said in there $94.2 million, and I thought you mentioned $180. What's that discrepancy?
Yeah, so since that time, when we brought the item to the MTA board, the issuance was expected to be much smaller. It was based on assumptions about an earlier time frame of issuance, and so now that things are actually going to be a little bit later than we had originally anticipated, the issuance will be larger. And so it'll move us to about half of the $500 million in total, along with the $66 million.
Okay. And also, in the narrative, it talked about money from the second issuance for complete street improvements and facility upgrades, but it didn't mention anything about traffic signal improvements and accessibility improvements. But then I thought you said the new amount, the larger amount, is going to cover all eight categories, so those categories will be covered?
Yeah, that's correct. Again, some of that information was a little outdated with the smaller issuance size. Now that we've sort of completed, you know, sort of cranking through all the numbers and seeing where our projects are in terms of need and cash flow, all eight categories will be represented in the second issuance.
Okay, because, again, my concern, it's already been 2 years since the first issuance, and I was thinking if these other four categories still didn't have projects ready, it kind of begs the question. So, but you know, eventually you'll have schedules for all of these projects.
Yes, and we do for all of them, yes.
And so off the top of your head, all the money will be spent by, do you have what, when the final project?
Third quarter of fiscal year 2021.
Okay, thank you.
Can you just clarify one thing? I think with the second issuance, you've now decided to include allocations to all eight programs, number one, and it's a larger number, but you're going to push it back timing-wise a little bit. Can you give us a sense of when the anticipated time frame of the second issuance, the larger amount, is going to be?
Well, a date has not been set, but I would anticipate sometime early next calendar year.
And so sometime in 2018.
Correct.
Any other comments?
I have a
Mr.
couple
Bush?
Of questions. Thank you. Have you got an estimate of how much time is being saved by this work for the people who are using our roads? You have an efficiency goal here. Do we have any idea of what the outcome looks like? Save 2 minutes, 5 minutes?
Yeah,
35
you minutes? You just expanded. Do you mean for all road users? You mean for transit users? For The goals of the project were to improve reliability and travel time for transit users while not negatively impacting auto users, and that's what we're seeing in the two.
But was there a specific time amount that would be saved?
I don't have it off the top of my head, but yes, there is. We have numbers for each specific project, and we're in the process of checking those numbers. I mean, you know, you do the before after, and you have to wait a little while after construction ends before you do the after. Data gathering.
And I would say in the detail report, for example, on the 7 Haight Noriega, it mentions the changes are expected to reduce transit travel time by 20%. Yeah. So I think they've got a lot of that information.
I have a hard time knowing 20% of what, though?
Total.
Yeah, I think it's a 14-minute trip.
Yes. I could kind of share something that Sean kind of shared with us. I think that for measuring the outcome before they actually introduce those changes, there is some kind of an expected a goal. Correct me if I'm wrong, Sean, but I think for each line, part of the planning is that, you know, they need to reduce X number of minutes or some statistic, and then they plan how to do it. And then at the end, they do measure it. Maybe you could share the very first project that was
one of the two projects that have been completed so far. One was Sansom. That was the first one completed.
Sansom,
did a contraflow lane for Sansom Street for the 10 and 12 lines, and we were projecting a minute and a half savings, and we're getting about a minute 40 second savings by that from that project.
That's the kind of thing I'm so the public knows what are we getting out of this.
Yeah,
personally, That's the kind of question.
Yeah, so great point. And, you know, like was Brenda and Robert both said, we have those numbers, our goals for each of these projects that we put in all the materials, and then we'll be measured against those after
the other issue, of course, is that there is a certain amount of disruption that takes place when you're doing things.
Yep.
And I see that there's a lot of concern in terms of the subway about the impact it's having in Chinatown, and that's not your issue, but nevertheless, it's related to the same kind of disruption. Do you have a best way of measuring feedback from businesses that are, and whether or not you're being responsive to their concerns?
Yes, we get a lot of feedback. We have actually several different methods. We have a small business working group that we meet with, and Director Riskin meets with once a month to go over both future plans as well as what's going on currently. As you know, construction right now, there's a lot of construction in the city, and it's only going to get more in the next few years. Some major corridors are going to be under heavy construction, like 19th Avenue, of course, Van Ness, Lombard, Market Street. So there's some major corridors that are going to be going through some major construction activity. So we've set up some working groups, set up some ways to hear feedback and try to address those.
My point is based on the impact on small businesses.
Yep.
Because they are the ones who are most vulnerable to a loss of patronage. And in San Francisco, small businesses account for the largest increase in new jobs in the city. In fact, San Francisco ranks in the top 10 in the nation for new job creation because of businesses that have under 500 employees. So to the extent that we are, that we need to take some steps to accommodate those businesses in the process of improving life for all of us, I'm raising that as something that belongs on the table.
If I could mention briefly, just because this topic has come up at this body and the Board of Supervisors and elsewhere, and we actually have two projects in our Controller's Office work plan for the year that are trying to get to some of these questions. One, we're in the midst of doing some sample testing of sales tax return information off of a handful of construction projects to see if from that information we can glean findings about the impacts on retailers affected or other businesses affected by right-of-way construction improvement projects. So this is responsive to some conversations we've had here. We're actually expecting to have some interim results this week to present, and we'll certainly forward on that interim report, our interim presentation to you, as well as others. So we're doing some analysis of these questions of right-of-way improvement projects and how they affect small and other businesses in the immediate vicinity. So that's a first half of the fiscal year project for us. And then in the second half of the fiscal year, again, this was in conversations with this body regarding our work plan. We intend to engage some public outreach consultants to sample resident feedback on a couple of construction projects.
After action report that we talked about.
Exactly. So we have in our work plan for the current fiscal year to conduct two of those reports for the coming year and see how we like the results and what next with them.
Good. Thank you.
You know, let me follow up with something on this business of disruption. That can provide a dilemma to the project management team. Sean, you told us last week about an intersection on the 30 Stockton where the work had been scheduled for nighttime. And to keep from disrupting traffic patterns. But Supervisor Peskin then forbade you from working at night because it was keeping the residents up. Both of these are legitimate concerns, but that's the kind of issue that you run into. So to say, well, you know, we can do things to mitigate the problem. You can do things to mitigate part of the problem, but you'll shift the problem to another area. So it may sound simple, but as is everything in life in general, and San Francisco in particular, it ain't.
Well, Well, I see no further comment from the committee. Thank you for your presentation. And at this point, I would like to invite public comment on the presentation. Seeing none, let's move on to the next item.
Item 6, presentation from the Recreation and Parks Department about the following bonds and possible action by the committee in response to such presentation. The 2000 Neighborhood Park Bond, the 2008 Clean and Safe Park Bond, 2012 Clean and Safe Neighborhood Parks Bond.
Good morning, GOBAC members. Dawn Cumlin-Athan, Director of Planning and Capital Management at the San Francisco Recreation and Parks Department. I'm joined today by our finance officer for the division, Antonio Guerra, and also David Beaupre from LaPorte. I'd like to thank them for their help in preparing this report for you. A quick presentation today, I think just highlighting actually what I think is a lot of progress over the past year, in particular on our bond programs. The 2000 bond is really, for all intents and purposes, it is complete. We have to do our closeout report with FSP coming online. That has slowed down our efforts to complete a lot of small accounting tasks as we've tried to prioritize our energy on things like getting contractors paid. So. But this program is complete. The projects have been delivered, and we are mostly hoping to just kind of produce a final bookend report that summarizes how those funds were spent and the projects that were delivered. Oops. The 2008 Clean and Safe Neighborhood Parks Bond likewise is also largely complete with about 1.5% remaining in that bond. Those funds are largely located in some of our smaller citywide programs, including Trails, Forestry, and Community Opportunity Fund. For Community Opportunity Fund, we actually allow a program that's designed to leverage philanthropic giving from the community. And so when we award, in quotes, a project, we give the community 3 years to come up with their leveraged funding and stewardship resources. And so there is sometimes a lag there in the expenditure of those funds, but we do expect them to be complete in the next year or two. For Trails and Forestry, we've been more constrained by the lack of bandwidth on the operations side of the department. Trails and Forestry both require deep cooperation with units inside Rec Park that have been historically extremely understaffed. And so that's meant that getting the bandwidth together on both teams has been a challenge. That being said, there has been additional hiring in our urban forestry unit that should really help us. We also have a project manager who's finally excited to be working on trees. And that is also, I think, a big boon to the program. And for Trails, with the passage of the significant natural resource area management plan. That EIR and that plan has taken up an extraordinary amount of time from the natural resources unit inside Rec Park over the past decade. And we're hopeful now that having cleared that hurdle, a lot of the kind of issues, like every forestry project kind of or trails project became a referendum around that entire program. And we hope that with its final adoption by the Rec Park Commission and also the appeal denied by the Board of Supervisors, we can all now move forward with a smoother implementation plan. 2012 bond spending really continues to move along. This focuses on the named neighborhood park projects in the 2012 bond, and of our existing issuance, about 80% of that has been expended or encumbered. West Sunset is in construction. Glen Canyon has opened to the public and has just, again, a few closeout areas. The back of the rec center needs to be completed. I'm sorry, not the building, but there's a picnic area in the back that needs to be completed. And with that, those funds should be expended. Balboa Pool also under construction right now. So we're making good progress on each of these. And also, I think over the next year, our main target is that many of these other projects, Margaret Hayward, Garfield Pool, excuse me, Moscone, Potrero Hill. These are all supposed to go into construction in spring, summer of the coming year. And so that poses both, and I'll talk a little bit more about this, that's a huge milestone for us in terms of really closing out the rest of the funding. It also means that we will be seeking a third sale probably in early calendar year 2018 to fund the remainder of the design work on those projects so that we can be ready to go into construction. And then this shows our current schedules for those same named projects. Our goal, which we are holding to right now, is to have all of these major neighborhood park projects delivered by November 2019, which is the ballot that's been scheduled for, by the 10-year capital planning committee for the next rec park GO bond. Citywide spending has lagged behind the neighborhood park spending, which has been a classic pattern for both 2008 bond as well. But there's a number of good pieces of good news, I think, on that front as well. A large portion of the citywide programs is in the Let's Play SF initiative. And that program is tied very closely to a philanthropic partnership with the San Francisco Parks Alliance, who has committed slightly over $10 million to leverage against the 15.5 that's been included in the bond. And two of those projects, Merced Heights and Washington Square, thanks. Merced Heights and Washington Square have had concept plans approved by the commission. We also expect them to be going to construction again roughly around this summer. And the philanthropic fundraising initiative has been very successful. We feel like we've made real progress and actually hope over some time in the next year or two to have met that total fundraising goal, which will really allow us to just push the rest of these projects out over the next year and start designing them. Similarly, the McLaren visioning process is almost complete. That will be complete, we hope, by October. And with that, we will have a clear set of priorities with the community and begin to be able to start designing those projects. And Stanley Street Edge is also in the edge, at the end of its community visioning process. And so we hope that this was part of our plan to really focus our resources on delivering the neighborhood park projects where we have a clear voter commitment, and to use the citywide programs as more flexible kind of buffer projects that allow us to kind of fill in the last year or two of the bond program. So that is all making very good progress, I think, over the next year. So these are just a few of the concept designs that we've been working on. Garfield Pool in particular, I think we're very excited about. We've been able to, again, leverage over another $5 million, I think closer to seven of Eastern Neighborhoods impact fees against bond funds, which is going to allow us to not just do the pool renovation, but to really transform the site and to make it really more of a neighborhood rec center in a lot of respects, demolishing a kind of dilapidated bunker of a clubhouse and creating more of a wing that's attached to the building, which should improve security and usability concerns at the site. Willy Woo Woo Wong in the upper right-hand corner is a very difficult site located on a very steep grade in Chinatown, but very heavily used by the community. And we've been working with CMG, a landscape architecture firm in San Francisco, to figure out a way, which I think we've been able to do, to really make every square foot at that site count for more than one use, and to have as much flexibility as possible. And the bottom is George Christopher Playground in Diamond Heights. This project has also finally gotten concept plan approval from the commission after a year of delays working with City Planning's preservation team to kind of evaluate the site as a historic resource. So next steps, again, 2012, a third issuance. We're planning for early 2018. Also, the life cycle analysis has really continued to make a lot of progress in the past few months. The life cycle analysis is the name of the project that's the name we've settled on to replace Comet. Comet was an asset inventory and condition assessment that the department conducted in 2006 that looked at all of our assets and gave them a condition assessment score relative to each other. That data set was extraordinarily valuable and important in shaping the structure of the 2008 and 2012 bonds, but it is, alas, now totally out of date, and also the vendor really no longer exists, and it's in the same form that it did 10 years ago. So we've been working to evaluate products on the market, look at our own best practices in the city, as well as look very carefully at our own business processes inside Rec Park about how we do long-term capital planning and how that connects to preventative maintenance cycles on the operations side. And it's, I think, yielded not only a good return, hopefully, in terms of the product that we're hoping to procure for the next round of assessment, but also spun off a number of kind of good analytical endeavors. The controller's office has lent us some staff to work through a lean business process of our operations yard, and that has resulted in a total reworking of how we're thinking about incorporating their feedback into capital projects that, again, long-term should result in facilities that are easier to maintain and can keep our maintenance costs down. Reserves. One of the things I'm working on right now and hope to complete in the next 2 months is a draft reserve policy for the general manager and Rec Park Commission's consideration. One of the risk factors, I'd say the largest risk factor to the program right now, is that the bidding climate continues to be inhospitable, let's call it that, towards government work. And we've seen bids, really we did an analysis from 2015, really summer 2015 was our turning point, where bids started to come in like 20 to 40% higher than what we had originally budgeted for when the projects were originally scoped. With our largest project, like Garfield Pool, Rossi Pool, Margaret Hayward, all going out to construction around the same time, around summer 2018, I think it's important that we engage the commission in early conversation that if the market continues to be to our disadvantage, how are we going to meet, deliver those projects as scoped with the public without suddenly facing, you know, having to come up with $5 to $10 million in a pinch. And that's been we started to have that conversation. The commission is very receptive to it. There are a number of options available to us about how we can handle that risk and address it successfully. But that is one of our top goals, is to deliver the projects as scoped with minimal impacts to the rest of, to other capital projects that might be in the queue and certainly other resources in the department. And lastly, we continue to transition to FSP, and we hope to also take advantage of that transition to really rethink some of our older reporting styles that we've provided to the Rec Park Commission, which have been reporting now on projects from like the early 2000s for a while. And our hope is that, again, we can wrap that up and create maybe a bookend report that reports on 2000 to 2015. And then from here on out really focuses only on active projects than continuing to report the past. So with that, I'll turn it over to my colleague, David Beaupre.
Thank you, Don. Committee members, David Beaupre with the Port of San Francisco. I'll be brief. For the 2008 bond projects, we have two remaining projects, the Blue Greenway Art Project at Bayview Gateway. That project is scheduled to be installed at the in October. So that project will be done. It slipped a little bit in schedule. The Arts Commission has been working with Public Works to get that back on track, but I'm assured it'll be done in October. And then we have Crane Cove Park, which is being funded by both the 2008 and 2012 bond projects. Here's the current schedule of the active projects, with the art being done in October. Crane Cove Park is under construction as we speak. We have a bid package two that's going to be going out again shortly. Then we have Agua Vista Park and Islay's Creek Improvements. Agua Vista Park is tied closely with Mission Bay Project and our downtown, or our Mission Bay Ferry Landing Project. That's schematic design is underway with that. And then we have the Islay's Creek Project, which is an open space connection between Tennessee and 3rd Street, and that project is somewhat linked with the Public Works rehabilitation of the Nishkin Bridge over Islays Creek, and that's we're working with Public Works on the design and construction of that. With that, I'm available for any questions. Thank you.
Mr. Tonneson, you have any comments?
Robert Carlson and I met with Don on August 29th for about an hour. I'm now taking over as the point person on the Park and Rec bond, so I really appreciated the time that she took explaining the bond process and some of the differences between the Rec and Park bonds and the rest of the bonds that this commission deals with. I also want to express my gratitude to Robert for being there and kind of helping with that handoff. I think that Don covered a lot of what we spoke about there in terms of the 2000-2008 bonds kind of wrapping up pretty quickly here. The 2012 bonds, it's pretty exciting all the progress that's been made. Robert and I did go for a tour of the Outer Sunsets facility on September 1st with Dan Maurer, and we saw the scale of that project. And one of the things that I think I really wanted to highlight was, so from my understanding, you know, the difference between some of the parks bonds is that the funding is tied specific to certain projects. So literally, we have a list of names of parks that need to be worked on. And I think that does pose some different constraints. And we saw that with our tour of the new park facilities, where I think that the original scope was a little bit bigger, but because as they explored the work that needed to be done and a lot of infrastructure under the ground needed to be worked on with drainage, et cetera, things like that, some of the project had to be scaled back a little bit. The end result is amazing, and it's going to be great for the community. But I think that because of the nature of having, you know, these parks called out specifically, kind of does, in a sense, tie folks' hands, you know, in some way in terms of what they can be doing. So it's really exciting the work that's being done. And again, I want to thank Don and Robert for being part of that meeting.
Good. Any other comment from the committee?
No, I thank you, Alex, for that. And I did go out to the West Sunset playground on the tour, and I also had visited that, and you might recall I mentioned when it was first breaking ground, and then to go back and see now that it's virtually complete, it was just spectacular. I gotta say it's one of the best projects, and it's 17 acres, it's huge. So I don't know when the opening is, but if you hear about it, I would definitely go out or take a chance to go out and see it, because it is really a spectacular, pristine, beautiful Rec and Park project for this city.
Thank you. Any other comment? Good. So I guess at this time, I'm going to invite public comment on the presentation. Seeing none, let's move on to the next item.
Item 7, opportunity for committee members to comment or take any actions on any matters within the committee's jurisdiction. Item A, CSA annual bond reports. This is a presentation.
If I can, I'll briefly just remind the committee members about kind of this product and why we're doing it, and I'll turn it over to David and Joe, who have done the work on it. So this is an annual general obligation bond report that our office performs. I believe we've done this for the last few years at the request of the committee and in consult, you know, kind of, it's one of those places where we have shared responsibilities related to voter initiatives to review progress on voter-approved bonds. And so this is a high-level view that we've done that touches all of the programs, and we're really, again, in much the same way that you are, looking to results on scope, schedule, and budget in an easily accessible report. So with that, I will turn it over to David.
Thank you very much, and thank you to the chair and the members of the committee. And so I'm David Weinzimmer, and I work in the City Performance Unit of the Controller's Office. And I'll present to you some of the highlights of the GO bond program report that you should have in your packets as well. And so the methodology for this report, there's three primary components. We start with information gathering from all the bond programs, and then we conduct interviews with the bond program managers and then summarize all of that with analysis and reporting, as well as comparison to the results from a year ago in our report. And the information gathering, we use not only information that we received directly from all the bond programs on scope, schedule, budget, and change orders as of December 31st, 2016. So that's an important note, is that all the information is presented as of December 31st, 2016, unless otherwise noted. So you've heard already today some updates from bond programs that are more up-to-date than that data. But in addition to the data we receive from bond programs, we also consult data submitted to GOBOC, the Capital Planning Committee, CCSF websites, the famous financial system, and the Office of Public Finance. And so some high-level findings about scope, schedule, and budget across all of the bond programs. All of the bond programs are on budget with relatively limited changes in scope. And of course, scope, schedule, and budget are all very interrelated. So if the budget and the scope are both very on track, the most of the changes that we have seen then have been with schedule. And that is what we've seen, with almost all bond programs experiencing some delay to schedules. And among the bond programs that were passed before 2014, so the older bond programs in the portfolio, all have experienced overall delays between 1 and 4 years, with the exception of the 2008 SF General Hospital rebuild bond, which has only experienced 3 months of delay. And so going through each of the bond programs individually, you can see the 2008 SFGH rebuild bond is an $887 million bond program delivered by Public Works. That's by far the largest bond program in the portfolio. And this bond program is 96% expended, with the main hospital having been completed in August 2015 with just 3 months of delay. And the remaining budget, since it was finished under budget, is funding 4 follow-on projects that are on the bottom right of the slide. One of the significant findings from this bond program is that pre-bond planning funding helped in delivering this very complex project that was the better part of a decade under budget and with only modest delays. Moving on to the Clean and Safe Neighborhood Parks bond programs, the first of those is the 2008 CSNP bond, which is $185 million. And is delivered by the Recreation and Parks Department and the Port. 93% of this bond program was expended as of December 31st, 2016. And the overall bond program is delayed by about 4 years, with the individual components within that bond program being delayed 3 to 7 years. So by components, I mean, for instance, with this bond, citywide programs, neighborhood parks, and waterfront parks. The delays to this bond program have been primarily due to delays in regulatory approvals, extended public outreach, or difficulty coordinating with site staff, particularly for citywide programs, which we heard a lot more detail about with the citywide programs, the reasons for those delays just a moment ago from Recreation and Parks Department. The 2012 CSNP bond is a $195 million bond program also managed by the Recreation and Parks Department and Port. This one is 24% expended and is currently delayed by 19 months to be finished by fiscal year by the end of fiscal year 2020. And the waterfront parks component within this bond program has been delayed due to coordination with adjacent sites. As we just heard, the schematic designs need to be completed for the adjacent Mission Bay Bayfront Park and for the placement of the ferry landing in order to be able to proceed with the Agua Vista Park within this bond program. And then neighborhood parks have been delayed due to staffing constraints, mitigation of operational impacts, and coordination. And so we heard in detail about all of these things just a moment ago. I'd like to highlight also with operational impacts, for instance, there's a limited number of pools in the Recreation and Parks Department system. So one of the considerations is to only take one pool out of service at a time, and that can have implications for the construction schedules to not have undue impacts on the park's users. One of the highlights of this bond program has been that the Recreation and Parks Department has applied lessons learned from the 2008 bond program to reduce delays due to CEQA and historic preservation issues. That was a more significant issue in the 2008 bond program, and they have in the queue of the neighborhood parks that they are constructing with the 2012 bond program, they have placed more of the parks that have known significant historical resources earlier in the queue so that they have more time to finish their environmental phase and not impact the overall schedule of the neighborhood parks bond component. On to the ESER bond programs. The 2010 ESER bond is a $412 million bond program delivered by Public Works and the SFPUC. And this first ESER bond program is 81% expended as of December. The bond program has been delayed overall by 27 months, with a minor three-month delay to the neighborhood fire stations in the past year, as well as a one-year delay to the auxiliary water supply systems component. And this is due to technical issues with Pumping Station 1, as well as the need to delay the Pumping Station 2 project until the Pumping Station 1 project has been completed. This is another instance where only one of the pumping stations can be offline at a time, and so that can have schedule implications if there's delay on the first pumping station project. One of the other highlights of this bond program is that there's been lower than expected cost of issuance for the bond program thus far, allowing for some of those funds to be allocated toward the neighborhood fire stations component for focus scope improvements. The next ESER bond program is the 2014 ESER bond program, with $400 million also for Public Works and SFPUC. And this newer ESER program is 19% expended as of December. The bond program is currently projected to be delayed by 3 months to June 2021. And this bond program has had some changes to scope over the past year, with those including the EFWS, the Emergency Firefighting Water System bond component, has removed flexible water supply systems from the scope and has redirected those funds to other pipeline projects and AWSS. The police facilities bond component has also added a simulation weapons training facility for the use of force, and the traffic company and forensic services division component has added facilities within that building for the body-worn camera unit of the SFPD. And moving on to the 2011 Road Repaving and Street Safety Bond Program, this $248 million bond program was 78% expended as of December, with the sidewalks projects component completed already. The bond program has been delayed overall by 1 year, with the components within this bond program delayed by 1 to 3 years. And the sources of delays that we've heard about in more detail also earlier today include interdepartmental coordination, extended public outreach, and unexpected site conditions. So with extended public outreach, a lot of the streetscape projects in particular have needed more outreach than expected. And unexpected site conditions includes the sidewalk accessibility component and the presence of subterranean basements under the sidewalk. One of the other highlights of this bond program also is that the pavement condition index has improved over the time frame of this bond program from 64 in 2011 to 69 in 2016. And the 2014 Transportation and Road Improvement Bond Program is a $500 million bond program delivered primarily by the SFMTA, with the Better Market Streets project within this bond program being delivered by Public Works. As of December, this bond program was 2.5% expended, and it was currently projected to be completed in December 2022, so no overall changes to the bond schedule as of our report publication. Although one of the components within it had had its schedule changed, the accessibility improvements component had been delayed by 3.5 years, and that was due to it being allocated for phase two of BART Canopy's projects for the shared BART and Muni stations on Market Street, which is a project that was delayed by BART. And in addition, all of the components were still projected to be on time, but we noted in the report that delays were likely absent an acceleration of project delivery, although as we saw earlier today, there's been a number of projects that have entered construction this calendar year for this bond program. And as you heard earlier as well, the majority of funds for the first issuance were for the Muni Forward component, and so the majority of delays to the bond program therefore have been within that component as well, and those have been primarily due to outreach and engagement being more extensive than anticipated to reach specific design for these projects, as well as contractor issues. As we heard earlier, the 5 Fulton was bid 3 times due to LBE requirements not being met on the bids. And then lastly, coordination. So there's extensive coordination necessary with any roadway projects, with PUC and Public Works and Utilities, as well as internal coordination for projects with Vision Zero. And the 2015 Affordable Housing Bond Program is a $310 million bond program delivered by MOHCD. As of December, that was 2% expended, with the completion projected for December 2023. With this bond program as well, we noted in the report that delays seemed likely absent an acceleration of project work. And the largest portion of bond funds for this bond program are for the affordable housing component, which funds both new construction and stabilization of existing housing through the Small Sites Program. And one of the notable highlights for this bond program is that although there's more than two dozen funding sources for MOHCD's projects, this is the only funding source that funds housing, it's the only funding source for households above 120% of area median income. And the last bond program is the 2016 Public Health and Safety Bond. That is a $350 million bond program delivered by Public Works. And this bond program was 2% expended as of December, and it was currently projected to be completed by November 2022. The largest portion of this bond program is for ZSFG Building 5, the former main hospital at San Francisco General, and which will serve as an ambulatory care center. And this bond program was passed in 2016 and had its first issuance of $173 million in February of this year. And most projects in this bond program are in planning or design at this point. And so some of the lessons learned across all bond programs, one thing that we heard from almost every bond program was that more funding for pre-bond planning and scoping would help the programs establish more precise scope schedules and budgets and also spend those funds more quickly. And that is, of course, highlighted by the experience of the 2008 SFGH rebuild bond program, which had that type of funding in advance. We also heard from Public Works in particular that bond programs need to be flexible about choosing the appropriate project delivery mechanism. So for instance, choosing between design build or a construction management general contractor project delivery method. And that needs to match both the project scale and the bid environment. So the bid environment, of course, is changing. The types of projects that were being bid well in one way 3 years ago are not performing as well in a current bid environment, particularly with trade subcontractors. And pre-issuance planning and regular GOBOC reporting should be standardized to enhance accountability and transparency of planned expenditure schedules and other key bond information. So you'll notice in the report this year we have a new analysis of comparing planned expenditure schedules to actual expenditure schedules. But that's a very difficult analysis to do without that information being collected in a standardized format prior to issuance. And then we also heard earlier from Public Works, the high volume of construction in this city strain city resources, and that's both private and public construction, can have an impact on these constrained resources. So the example, one of the primary examples of this is that any work that's near the overhead lines for the Muni service requires reroutes to that service, and there's a fixed number of motor coaches available to do that with, as well as the transit supervisors, inspectors that facilitate those reroutes as well. And overall, across the bond programs, the most common reasons for delays include delays for regulatory approvals, for increased public outreach, and interdepartmental coordination. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Before I open up for questions, I just want to congratulate the Comptroller's Office, especially in the presentation slides, of what a good job you've done in a one-pager to really report on all the salient aspects of that one bond. So congratulations to the Comptroller's Office. I'm now open up for comment by other members. Mr. Larkin.
C'est moi. I had two questions on at least two of the slides. You referred to delays. You said delays appear likely absent an acceleration of project work. Do you mean accelerating a contractor on a contract that's already been issued because his work has been delayed by the owner, us, or do you mean just issuing the contracts more quickly, you know, just getting something on the street in December rather than the following July or something like that?
Yeah, and so for those two bond programs are the SFMTA 2014 Transportation Bond Program and the 2015 Housing Bond Program. Yes. And so we were just commenting on the pattern of the end dates had not been updated at that point for either of those bond programs. The end date for Muni Forward projects overall had not been changed, for instance, but it was not proceeding at the same pace as had been foreseen, mm-hmm. for instance, 2 years prior. And so we were just commenting that it seemed likely that the commencement of construction having not started on the same schedule as anticipated, that it was likely it would not be finished on the same time frame as expected. But we didn't have an official change in end date to report on.
Okay. So, in other words, the city isn't exposed to delay claims from a contractor on a contract that's already ongoing, and that, and that's good news. That's the answer. I was hoping to hear that answer. Yeah. And finally, secondly, on your list of the three most common reasons for delays, you had delays for regulatory approvals, increased public outreach, and interdepartmental coordination. And we heard about that, Brenda and I, when we spoke to the MTA people on the 2014 bond last week. The delays for regulatory approvals, now that's something that I would hope there's a plan to mitigate that, because there's always going to be the need for regulatory approval. You know, is anyone looking at that?
Which were you talking about that with the bond programs overall or with one in particular?
I'm just looking at your general comment here on the last page.
Yeah, and a lot of that refers to environmental clearance, for instance, or regulatory permits. So, for instance, for Crane Cove, there had been delays with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to receive a permit for waterside work. And with the CSNP programs, we'd heard about many delays, particularly in the 2008 bond program. So we've definitely seen improvement in the 2012 bond program on dealing with starting the environmental clearance process earlier for neighborhood parks programs. But it's still, of course, a pattern that we've seen for the 2008 bond program.
I think that now State Senator Weiner, I'm saying senator, I'm not sure if he's an assembly person or senator, but I think he is sponsoring legislation to make some changes to the CEQA process so that it isn't so time-consuming for what otherwise seem like pretty straightforward projects, you know, changing what used to be a rail yard into a rail yard again. It was a rail yard before, you know. But and the middle one you had there, increased public outreach. I know that I think when Corey Marshall was the liaison on the 2014 bond, we had some discussion about that, where it can be never-ending, you know, and I think maybe an overall policy at the city level on how much they're going to do, what the scope of it is going to be, and at what point you're going to cut it off, because it does have implications for how quickly these projects get delivered, as you note in writing right here. That's all the questions I have.
I just want to reiterate Brenda's comment. I thought the detailed report was outstanding, and I really appreciate the work of you and the staff on this report. It's very, very informative, and I highly recommend it, you know, for if people want an idea of what's going on with general obligation bonds. This is an excellent document, and great job.
Thank you very much.
Well, I had something to add to Mr. Carlson's comment, and this is directed to the controller. The detailed report is excellent as far as, like I said, hitting all the salient aspects. Is there any way you can convince or persuade each of the bond program managers to structure and deliver their report in a similar fashion, so that in some ways you would have a standardized template for them to follow, and would be very helpful for us as we read them on regular updates. So it's just a suggestion.
No, it's a good suggestion, Madam Chair, and it's actually in your work plan for the current year is pushing along the standardization of the reporting templates for departments. We just need to help you do that, frankly. You have a couple of presentations you've had today that are in the template that the committee had previously worked out. So the John Thomas's presentation of the street bond earlier today was in that kind of more visual summary level presentation, and we need to just push that out to departments, and you need to help us push them when they come forward with presentations that aren't in that format.
Perhaps we could have a follow-up for you to tell us how you, the controller's office, can help us do that. For example, in the Parks and Recs presentation slides, it should have been more along the lines of this current one that the controllers did. Because for each bond, there's the actual name of the bond, the dollar amount, the programs, and very succinct, all very high level stuff. So maybe you can tell us how you can help us convince the departments to follow that.
Why don't we summarize an approach for the remainder of the fiscal year, and we can send that to the committee for your review, and talk about it at the next meeting a bit.
So can I suggest, we're scheduling a meeting with the CSA review before the November meeting, and so maybe that should be a topic of the conversation. And of course, once that's scheduled, I'll let all the members know, so if anyone wants to come also, we can do that. But it seems like this reporting thing is, So this is fantastic. Thank you. This is like a reference Bible for me. Certainly, I read it, and I will continue to study it as our agenda evolves over the year. Thank you for the lessons learned. And I think that the one that's specifically to us, we this is exactly what we're talking about, is we need to actually do this better. I also see that you suggested pre-issuance, and I think that's fantastic. I think we sort of let those issuances go by, where that is our only teeth in this whole matter, is to hold an issuance. And so we even should think about how this body's agenda fits in with the issuances that are coming up. Because we sort of find out afterwards, and that's not sort of the way we should be doing this. So we can also talk about that when we meet, hopefully in October. I think that one of the things I want to address is something Alex said earlier, which is concerns about, you know, these bonds are written in such a strict way about how the funding is at the project level, which is which we now, you know, I mean, obviously we can see that it happens across the board. I mean, there's these, you know, lofty names for these projects for these bonds, and then there's 19 or there's multiple projects underneath it, and there, if they're allocated funds, then it just ties the hands of the people that are trying to do these projects, and I think that your first lesson learned about the pre-bond planning is, you know, really sort of addresses that. It also addresses the three issues on the bottom about, you know, public outreach and things like that. I mean, knowing what you're getting into before getting in there. And so I guess my question is, how can we start to address this pre-bond funding? I think that the SF General rebuild was actually paid for by the funding for that pre-bond stuff was actually paid for by the department, I think. If I remember correctly, or they had, you know, but there's so much money in that area that, you know, I'm sure they had some flexibility there. So, is there anything we can do in this area to really either suggest or mandate you can't take something to the voters without actually knowing what you're asking for?
I just point out the public health, the 2016 public health and safety, $350 million. It's expected to be complete in 2022. That's 6 years. And that had a fairly significant pre-bond effort, as you might
recall. So that's an example of one that might come.
And whereas I'm looking at the 2010 earthquake safety, and I don't know exactly when, but it's already, what, seven? And I think it's still got a long ways to go. And I don't know if there was pre-bond. I think there is a lot of credence to the pre-bond. But and Ben, you probably know the Capital Planning Committee is the one that approves issuance of bond funds, right, through their 10-year capital plan and scheduling.
Correct.
And that we would, I can't recall, but Brian would come in and give a report. I don't know if we have that on our agenda. Okay, we do. All right. And that's where we would begin to learn about planned issuances. Mm-hmm. But there's no requirement that there be pre-bond efforts, right?
No requirement, although a stated goal of the 10-year capital plan is the city and the mayor and the board adopting a formal plan for when they intend to pursue future GO bonds, looking out years, which then enables you to plan for them if you have money available to do so. The general hospital bond was the better part of 2 years of design, frankly, before making its way to the voters at a cost of about $30 million out of the general fund. The idea that was put forward at that time was that the general obligation bond, if approved by the voters, would reimburse that cash appropriation, which would flow into a revolving fund that would then be turned around to fund the next project. And unfortunately, the moment of the refund on the general hospital bond happened to coincide with the bottom of the recession. And so the mayor and the board made a policy choice in 2009 or 10 to basically pull that cash back and use it to balance the operating budget. So that set us back a bit in terms of these efforts. But since then, and actually just in the last 2 years, that recommendation of a revolving fund has actually been formally adopted legally. And the recent sales have reimbursed into that fund, which provides more resource available to plan for the coming one. So I think that's a positive step. It was certainly one of my big takeaways from David and the team's good work here was just the importance of that. To get out of the gate quickly after the voter initiative and begin spending real money, we have seen some challenges with that on the two most recent bonds. And I also believe that it's helpful for establishing realistic schedule expectations, too. I do have a sense that some of the schedule slip we're seeing is related to delays that we can better avoid as a government. But I also believe that some of it has to do with setting real expectations. And that development of schedules is part of that pre-design work as well. But you will have Brian Strong here in the not-too-distant future to present the capital plan, and in particular the next two GO bonds. So this would be a good question to ask of him regarding the seawall bond that's coming up and the Rec and Park bond on the ballot after that.
I assume that there's part of the reason of listing all these projects is to get the voters to say yes. So there's no way to write the bonds in a generic way that, I mean, I know I look at what is going to affect me personally in these bonds and say,
well, actually most of the GO bonds, and it's not a global, but most of the legal language that governs the expenditure of the GO bonds in general is written more broadly. But it's often and has been typically accompanied by a project intent plan, mm-hmm. Which sets expectations for what's going to happen. There are some exceptions to that. The 2008 Parks Bond, I believe, maybe had more specific projects baked into the voter initiative themselves. But there is some flexibility in terms of the voter authorization. But again, I think part of the hope, one of the lessons, big lessons learned, I believe, for the government with the 2000 Parks Bond was it was a more general authorization without really a very specific plan as to how those funds were going to be expended after the fact, which facilities. And the result was after the voter initiative was passed, the city went through the planning process then to determine what the priorities would be. And the city overcommitted on many fronts to complete many projects. And fell short on delivery. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the bond challenges in the early 2000s that led to the 10-year capital plan, led to the creation of this committee and others. So we don't want to move too far away from having specific plans in place when we go to the voters.
Yeah.
If I recall correctly, the one of the parks bonds allocated $30 million for parks at the waterfront, but had nothing specific except that it was going to go to the port for parks. And that was like, okay, that's lovely, but what exactly are you talking about? Where or anything else was?
Yeah, and we see in from your findings that the port's having trouble executing anyway, right? So who are we giving the money to? I had one other comment about your methodology. We've been talking about you looked at scope, schedule, and budget, and so we've been talking here a lot about where the expectations met. And spending some time this year trying to survey voters and get their feeling on that. So that might be, as we look forward and start to gain information about, you know, where the voters' expectations met, that might fit in with your sort of framework here, although this is before the bonds are done, but it's something to think about.
I do have one comment. I one of your earlier slides, you made a notation that bonds passed, there was a difference in the way the bonds have progressed for bonds prior to 2014 and bonds after 2014. Can you comment a little bit more on that and you know, why 2014 seemed to have been an important year?
Yeah, so the reason for that is simply because 2014 was a natural cutoff for any of the bonds after that are very new. They only have one issuance. They may just be starting to enter construction or be primarily in planning and design, for instance, with the 2016 bond program. So the newer bond programs are just very unlikely to have had delays at this point since there hasn't been much time elapsed with the bond programs to need to readjust their expectations. If we had included the bond programs that are more recent, we would have said, I believe, that there are no delays at all for those bond programs, but they haven't had a chance to really test those assumptions yet.
Thank you. So we've learned, and it seemed like the city or the bond programs have learned lessons from prior bond programs, so that the newer ones seem to be progressing with less delays.
Well, we did note on two of the programs that are after 2014, we noted that we thought that it was likely there would be delays in the future, absent an acceleration of project delivery. So I think...
Well, good. Those are good red flags, I call them, as I read them. I mean, you did note that because you had certain delays, but the end date hadn't changed, that's a natural red flag for you to go back, for us to go back to them to say, you've delayed start date, but you still have the same end date, so...
It's kind of our way of saying that while a department hasn't yet formally declared a delay, if trends continue as we see it, we should expect delays.
Thank you. Any other questions?
I wanted to make a suggestion, as good as the report is, that there are two pieces that I think would be better for the public. One is, in addition to the amount of money that is in the bond, I'd like to see us include information on how much money is being leveraged by the bonds. So, for example, on affordable housing, the $310 million from the bond actually turns out to be about $12 million, $1.2 billion, whatever it is. I'm good with words, not math. So, but anyway, it's about a 3-to-1 ratio. And I know the affordable housing bond was intended to leverage money. I would imagine that some of the other bonds also have a leverage factor. Certainly, we get some federal money for streets and for different money for parks and so forth. So there's a leverage that comes in. And I think it would help the public see that the money that the city is putting in through a bond is generating additional funds going to accomplish a greater purpose. So that's one thing that I think would be useful to add to the report. And the second thing is that given the focus that everyone has on job creation, if somewhere in the report it could talk about the FTEs that are created both by the public and private sector as a result of the spending, since it does have a job generator effect, since we're spending money. And I think that that's something the public would like to see.
We're throwing in wish lists. To play back to something Larry has said, you know, a few meetings ago, is that it would be interesting to understand the impact in the different neighborhoods of the city. I mean, I think that we're all sensitive to some neighborhoods, you know. I mean, even across all the bond programs. I mean, the equity in the city, I think, is a big issue.
I think that's a big issue for the public.
Any other comments? Well, good. We'll conclude on this item. Thank you, David. Let's go to the next item, which is
public comment.
Yes, we have to do that. Before you go, David, I'm going to invite public comment on your presentation. Seeing none, I will consider it concluded.
Item B, Goldbach Annual Report Discussion for Fiscal Year 2016-17.
Goldbach members, you were given an updated version of a covering letter when you came in this morning. If you haven't had a chance to take a look, you can read it because that's the draft version that we're going to vote on and comment and before we send it to the mayor and the Board of Supervisors. There were some editorial comments or corrections of factual data that were made.
Well, as far as the draft cover letter, it looks like it's been changed quite a bit. I had a comment in there about how they were televised now and a lead up to some of the kind of comment that we had received from the public over the past several years. and it was more forthright than what's in there now. Do we have a copy of what I wrote? Because I don't. Could we read that paragraph?
You have it in your packet.
Do we?
It's right behind the bond report from CSA. That is the original.
Okay. Yeah, if you could, if that is in the package, that's the second last paragraph on the first page, beginning further on public input to our meetings. We seldom get comment from more than two or three people, and much of that is that we are not adequately meeting our responsibilities in accordance with the above-mentioned propositions that form CGOBOC. As a group, our committee members believe we're doing a good job of monitoring bond performance, especially because we're volunteers and meet only bi-monthly. I'd like to keep that in, because that is what happens. And for us to...
I'm sorry, I don't see that. Where is that? I'd like to be able to...
Oh, okay, here. Why don't you just take a look at what I got here?
Which paragraph?
The second last one. It begins further to that, I think.
What does that mean, further on public input?
Further to the public input. Doesn't the paragraph before that refer to public input in the whole television thing?
Is it helpful to the committee if I briefly read the paragraph that Mr. Larkin has suggested adding in?
Yeah.
The paragraph is on the original cover letter. It's paragraph 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, towards the end of the first page. If you have it, it reads, "Further on public input to our meetings, we seldom get comment from more than two or three people, and much of that is that we are not adequately meeting our responsibilities in accordance with the above-mentioned propositions that formed CGOBOC. As a group, our committee members believe we are doing a good job of monitoring bond performance, especially because we are volunteers and meet only bi-monthly." So I think that's the paragraph you're recommending.
Exactly.
To reinsert into the cover letter.
Yeah.
What are you saying in that paragraph? I'm not quite sure.
Well, if it's not that clear, then that's a problem. But what I'm saying is we usually get comment from the same two or three people, and I'm not going to mention their names, and none of them are here today, but it's usually negative, and it's that we aren't adequately meeting our obligations as a committee in accordance with the requirements of the two propositions that we operate under. We think that we are, and we think that we're going to continue to work in that way, given that we only meet bi-monthly. Every 2 months we get here together, and we're volunteers. We're not professionals. We're not full-time employees. So I wanted to make it clear that we're happy enough with what we're doing despite what we hear from public comment. Then I pose the question make the request that since now there is this television, and the reason that we implemented this SFGov TV program was to give more people access to our meetings, what are they, the Board of Supervisors, hearing from the people who are now seeing us on television, if any?
Well, again, I just say I don't see the need for this in an annual report to the mayor and the Board of Supervisors. Public comment. It, part of the nature of public comment is to get positive and negative comments. So
I'm waiting to hear the positive.
Well, I've heard some. And, I just don't see the need for it in here. It seems to maybe draw attention to an issue that's not really an issue.
Well, it's been an issue to me. I guess I'm the one who wrote the letter. But if the rest of the committee doesn't or don't agree it's appropriate, well, we can go to the revised letter.
Let me comment just to share my opinion. I tend to agree with Mr. Carlson. I think that especially with public commissions and committees, public comment is part of the game. And especially with the city government, we strive to be a very transparent body. So I think that we should not make an issue of public comment, whether it's positive or negative.
I don't know that I made an issue. I just reported on what I see we're getting. I'm not saying, we shouldn't have it anymore. I recognize that we will have it anymore. And we've been through the training, I think all of us, on what the Sunshine Law requires of us and how there is no, how we can't limit public comment, even if it's abusive for that matter. But that's beside the point. What is the point, though, is that we do hear the same two or three what I call usual suspects coming in, and I seldom heard anything positive from them. Matter of fact, I can't name a time that we've heard anything positive from them. So alluding to that in a report, again, we're volunteers. We meet every 2 months. We're doing what we can. And I think it's within our rights to respond to the negative comment that we get. And that's where I'm coming from.
If I could just make an observation, it is the nature of public comment to come and complain. That is what people do.
That's right. And I responded.
I'm just saying, as it is what happens at every commission.
Yeah.
And it's also in the nature that there are a few people who are very interested in the particular commission. You can take a look at the police commission. You have the same people who come every week and talk about the same issue about police response or police alleged violence and so forth. It is what our government set up, which was a commission form of government designed to be staffed by people who are volunteers from the community. That's one of the few cities in the country which actually operates on a commission form of government and has been doing since the 1930s. So I think the fact that we have a few regulars who come and who voice a desire for us to be doing more than we're doing is pretty much the way it is. And while many of the comments can be interpreted as critical of us, other comments, while suggesting that we're falling short, have included recommendations of ways in which we might make improvements. For example, some of the things that we were doing, like the after-action reports, came from public comment to begin with. Mm-hmm. So I think that calling attention to the fact that we're a volunteer group, because all the commissions are volunteer groups, and that we hear complaints is the same thing that happens to every commission. I'm not opposed to doing it. I'm just giving what I think is context from my experience seeing other commissions and the way city government works. And if you want to talk to people who hear a lot of complaints, I wouldn't take it to the Board of Supervisors if you've ever heard their public comment.
Yeah, well, they're on the payroll.
Well, they may be on a payroll, but
they are.
It'd be hard to pay them enough to sit through some of the songs that they listen to.
Oh, no doubt about that. But from my point of view, I'm not saying we should limit it. Don't even imply that. But I am saying I think we got the right to respond to it.
This may not be the place to do it, though.
What other place you recommend?
That's my feeling. You do have a right. I just don't think it's appropriate to be in the our annual report to the mayor and the Board of Supervisors. So to move things along, if appropriate, I would make a motion to approve the annual report to the board and the mayor as amended in the handout we received today.
Can I submit some typos? That's not going to change anything, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Mostly to my own stuff.
Need a second.
Thank you. And I was second.
Public comment?
Take a vote? Or
public comment.
Yes. Should we take a vote at who is... should we take a vote on the recommendation on the table? All in favor, say aye.
Need to take public comment.
Aye.
offer public comment briefly.
So how many ayes do you have?
Wait, we need public comment first.
Oh, okay. So before we vote, let's take public comment. Seeing none, we'll resume to voting by the committee members. All in favor?
Do you want roll call vote or voice vote?
No.
No?
Voice vote?
Sure.
The voice vote's fine. We see how it's going to go.
So all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
So we have five ayes. Correct? Three, four, five. So I think the motion passed.
Yep.
This meeting is now
concluded.